14, gusting to 25. 31 degrees Kenosha, 30 Racine, wind chill minus 1. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending most of today's morning show previewing a production that is about to open at the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha. And it is one of the most sparkling musicals to emerge over the last decade. The musical is Anastasia. And to get us in the mood for this lovely show and for the discussion that is going to ensue, we're going to listen to just a little bit of one of the chief songs that is part of this score, a song called In My Dreams, sung by the title character.
They said I was found by the side of a road. There were tracks all around. It had recently snowed. In the darkness and cold, with the wind in the trees, a girl with no name and no memories but these. Rain against a window, sheets upon a bed, terrifying nurses whispering overhead. Call the child Anya, give the child a hat. I don't know a thing before that. Traveling the back roads, sleeping in the wood, taking what I needed, working when I could, keeping up my courage, foolish as it seems, at night all alone in my dreams.
That song really embodies so much of the heart and soul of this musical called Anastasia, based, of course, on the remarkable and intriguing legend that Anastasia, one of the daughters of the Tsar of Russia, escaped the execution that otherwise engulfed the rest of her family. And the mystery that surrounded that intriguing possibility is at the heart of this story. Joining us today in our studios for this preview of the Lakeside Players production of Anastasia is Alex Ebert, who is the director of the production. Alex has joined us before. And three members of the cast, Peyton Kurianowicz, who is Anastasia, Trevor Milne, who is Dimitri, Brian Dean, who is Vlad. And we will be hearing from each of them about their particular characters and about this intriguing story and lovely score and the performances that happen at the Rohde Center for the Arts beginning this coming weekend. We welcome all of you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Glad to have you. Glad to have you here. So I don't know who wants to take a stab at talking a little more about this legend of Anastasia surviving the events of 1917. Whoever wants to describe that to our listeners in a little more detail, I just gave a little hint of what we're talking about.
Sure. So the story of the musical actually takes place pretty close to history, whereas the movie is a little bit more fantastical and has some more magical characteristics to it. This one takes place closer to history, where the Romanov family is actually betrayed by a lot of the people that are closest to them, and it leads to kind of a massacre of the family, with Anastasia being the only surviving member.
Supposedly.
Yes.
Within the realm of this musical, we should probably hasten to ask that it really has been quite conclusively determined that Anastasia, in fact, did not survive, but there were these very persistent rumors for various reasons that she had.
Yeah, and funny enough, at the end of the musical, it actually kind of acknowledges that. Like the very end stinger of the musical is talking about how Anastasia doesn't exist. She was kind of just this story that was made up to ease the sadness of the occurrence.
Sure, it's a story people wanted to be true.
Yeah, yeah, it was a story of hope at the end of it all.
So explain to our listeners this musical and its relationship to the animated film that maybe some of them have either seen or heard about.
Yeah, so as I said, the musical is a lot more historically based. So characters like Rasputin, the sorcerer, or Bartok, the bat, they're not in this musical. Rasputin is actually replaced by a character called Gleb Vagonov, who is the deputy commissioner, I believe.
Of the Bolsheviks.
Of the Bolshevik Soviet Union army. And he has this kind of weird tug of war within himself, where he's torn between his duty to his country and these feelings that he has for Anya. And he is trying to protect her from what he believes is a situation that is just going to get her killed, because he has seen time and time again that when people try to be Anastasia or try to convince people that they are Anastasia, it never works out, and they always end up at the end of a firing squad. So he is trying to protect her, but he also knows that he has to stop her from doing this thing. So it's a little bit darker than the movie. Actually, I will say it's a lot darker than the movie, because it is so steeped in the actual history of Russia in the 20s and the transference from royalty to the Soviet Union. So
I have to say, and I've not seen the show yet, I'm looking forward to taking in a performance during your run. I was really surprised as I read the rundown. I knew some of the songs, loved several of the songs a lot, but then I read through the synopsis and I was really taken aback by just how dark it is and how much it really steps on some sorrowful themes, although by no means is that the whole story with this musical.
Yeah, and I definitely, when we did our first read through, the president of our theater, Katie Gray, who I believe you've met before, she actually has this like really big affinity for history. So she came in and she gave us an actual historical rundown of the overthrow of the Romanovs. And when I heard that and I heard just how dark it was, in that moment I was like, I'm going to lean into the darkness of this so that we have a stark contrast between the massacre at the beginning, which, full disclosure, the beginning of our show is a little bit intense, because I wanted to then have that contrast into the rest of the show, which is still somber but has some lighthearted moments. There are a good few laughs in them, the least of which come from Vlad. Vlad is a very funny character. He's played by Brian Dean, who's with us today. But yeah, I didn't want to shy away from that part because it makes the rest of the musical feel more enheartened and positive.
And it's certainly part of the story, that's for sure. And this musical, to a surprising degree, I think is true to that. For those of you just joining us, we are previewing the Lakeside Players production of Anastasia, the musical, which opens this coming weekend at the Rohde Center for the Arts. In a moment, we'll meet Peyton, who is the title character, Anastasia, or Anya. But first, we're going to meet the two gentlemen who are playing kind of partners in crime, the two con men, Dmitri and Vlad, because they are part of why this character of Anya then sort of appears on the scene and in the center of everything. So, gentlemen, between the two of you, explain who Dmitri and Vlad are and what you have in mind, your scheme, which ultimately draws in this young lady named Anya. This is Brian.
So I would say that for Dmitri and Vlad, they're kind of two different sides of a coin. One of them has like grown up in Petersburg, which existed before the revolution, now transformed into Leningrad, and has basically grown on his own without anyone to take care of him. And then you've got Vlad, who's been a man who's been around for a long time. He has spent his time getting to know the Romanov family and essentially scamming his way to the top by getting himself into a little affair with a Lily Countess, the Countess Malievsky Malevich. And now that the revolution has happened, these two different sides of the changing atmosphere in Russia are coming up with this scheme in order to, well, essentially escape from what is now a dreadful place to live in.
And their scheme is?
Their scheme is to find an actress who will play the role of Anastasia in order for her to pretend that she actually lived so they can reunite with her family in Paris and hopefully get a small little reward out of it, but most importantly, to escape from Russia.
That's right. And I think the elderly Dowager Empress lives in Paris. That's what draws you to Paris?
Yes, she has issued a large sum of money to help find her long lost granddaughter, which is Anastasia. And Dmitri heard this over the streets of the rumors that Leningrad has been
disseminating.
Yes, and so through that information, he decided to then ask Vlad to help him find another Anastasia to hopefully convince the Dowager Empress to give him the money.
So this is all about money, actually. And so you are searching for someone who can be the right person, the right young woman to impersonate Anastasia.
Yeah, like you can tell at the beginning of the show, there's actually, the two con men are holding auditions. They go through multiple candidates in which they try and determine who is going to be able to pull off this scam, who is going to be the most convincing. They're pretty much at the end of their tightrope because all the candidates they have before can't really pull it off. But then they have this last-minute auditioner come in and she explains her situation. She's got amnesia. She doesn't necessarily know where to go next, but all she heard is that these two con men are trying to escape to Paris, and she wants in. And eventually, after a little convincing performance, we decide to go with her.
And actually, it was the song you heard at the top of the show that Anya sings to convince them.
Ah, very good. The song In My Dreams. So, Peyton, you perform the role of Anya. Tell us more about her and about the kind of intriguing place that she has in the midst of all this in terms of who exactly she is.
So Anya is this really, really pretty, like, beautifully complex character, where at the beginning of Act One, she is this girl who has amnesia. She doesn't know anything except for that there's someone waiting for her in Paris. So she's walked across the links of Russia trying to find someone who can help her, where she finally hears about these two men that are trying to get out of Russia. So she goes and she joins them. She's convincing them to take her in, and they finally do. And then the first act is about their journey to Paris. And over the course of the act, we're getting more and more hints that maybe this Anya is someone more than they had originally thought, more than just this girl who's good at playing Anastasia. And in Act Two, when they finally get to Paris, more and more coincidences start happening. And at one point, this memory that Anya has is directly linked to something that Anastasia actually did. And when we actually find out that Anya is Anastasia, and when she meets up with her grandma, it solidifies more that they are family. And she's kind of torn in the second act between being Anya and being Anastasia. And then at the end, she decides that she would rather be with Dmitri and be Anya than be a princess with her grandmother.
Trevor, who portrays Dmitri, tell us more about the relationship that the two of you have and how that evolves over the course of the show.
Sure. So starting out in the show, I was at my length's end trying to get someone to play Anastasia to get our little sum of money that we were just really striving for. And we found a girl who just about was able to pull it off. So we were like, we're just going to have to go with it because there's literally no one else we could go with. So at that point, he was just a little irritated and just trying to get through with this scheme of his at any means necessary. And so we see a little like playful banter between the two. That's just more just him just being a little like, it's like almost like having like a brother-sister relationship at the beginning. It's very playful and very like nagging against the two people. And then as the story progresses and they get through Russia and they get all the way to Paris, and she reveals more that she might actually be Anastasia, and Dmitri starting to like recognize that himself, he gets to this realization moment where he has to come to the fact between leaving her to get the money, because there's no way to have Dmitri and Anastasia together after she meets her grandmother, because she's going to have to live as a princess and away from him. And he doesn't realize that until the very last second, right when she gets introduced to the Dowager Empress, where it's already past the point of no return, and he can't really make any more decisions to help his own way of thinking at that moment. So it's a very like central moment where he sings this song called Everything to Win.
And let's hear just a little bit of that song called Everything to Win, in which we experience some of that emotional and mental tug of war in the mind of Dmitri.
What are they saying? Wonder how long they'll be. Why should I worry? Worrying's not like me. Nothing to do but pace and stew and wait till the girl walks in. Why panic now with everything to win?
Trevor, what's it like to play a role like this where there is this sense of kind of emotional limbo. I should think it's a really exciting opportunity for you as a performer.
It was very exciting, but it was also a little like nerve-wracking because I didn't. It's because you don't know how the character thinks, and the character doesn't know how they think. So it's just a whole like limbo space of just trying to figure out how somebody would act in this moment. So it's been a very enjoyable time playing as Dimitri, and I really hope that he's portrayed well when people come and watch our show.
Yeah. Brian, your character of Vlad has a very different sort of personality, and his presence in the show is really, really different. You have your own love affair on the side that adds a little interesting texture to the show. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, absolutely. What I love playing about Vlad is that in a very dark show, he is kind of the comic relief in all of this. So it's kind of like making the best out of a bad situation, which is something I always like to try and live by in my normal life. So being able to present a sort of animated quality in order to, you know, bring a couple smiles to people's faces is always really fun. And the good thing about playing Vlad is that with that whole affair that he has with the Countess Lily, it's a nice little side story as opposed to the main story that you get in between Anya and Dimitri. Because Lily technically is his own sort of love story, given that, you know, it could be a little different from what Anya and Dimitri have. But it's still very playful and also really funny in itself. Just with their little duet that they have with each other, you can see how they're all pretending to be coy or maybe not so much into each other. But in the end, they're drawn together like a magnet.
Mm. Very good.
Yeah, and Vlad and Lily's relationship actually plays a pretty pivotal role in Act 2 because Lily is the Empress's lady-in-waiting. So Vlad reconnecting with Lily gives them the in to then get Anya to meet the Empress. So it is this nice, very sweet side romance that happens, but also serves a very important purpose to our story.
It's a nice way to converge the two merging stories together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Alex, I wonder if you could say a word about some of just the kind of logistical and theatrical challenges that are part of doing a show of this complexity and scope.
Yeah, so one thing about the Broadway version of Anastasia that holds true for the community theater version of Anastasia is it does not allow very well for a static set. So all of the scenes and all of the settings are done through moving set pieces and projections. And our theater is not accustomed to having large moving set pieces. So my biggest logistical problems have been finding out how we can organize backstage so that A, everything is easily movable to where it needs to go. B, it does not cast shadows on the projection screen because we're back projecting.
Okay.
And then C, how to get it on and off stage without it taking forever. Some of that we're still working out, but otherwise it has been magic to see our stage crew come in and find this pattern of movement so that it feels smooth and natural. And then the other logistical thing is we do have a live orchestra for this show. And so we spent a lot of time in this process using the rehearsal tracks. And then we have a band come in, and of course, that's going to be a little bit different.
Sure.
So adjusting kind of in the home stretch to find out how the music is going to sound with the band versus how it sounds with the tracks was a little bit of a challenge for us. But I think we've really pulled it off into something that's quite spectacular.
Wow, very good. And this production opens this coming weekend. I'm just curious, with the three young people in the room, what did you know, if anything, about this legend of Anastasia before becoming acquainted with the musical? Is this something that's been part of, you know, your understanding of 20th century history at all?
So I found out about the history after the musical, and it's always been one of my favorites. So as soon as I learned that the Anastasia musical was based off of a real story, I learned about the actual story a few years ago.
And is your character of Anya, are you supposed to be parallel to a woman by the name of Anna Anderson, who is probably the most famous woman who said she was Anastasia? Is that just a coincidence that it's Anna and Anya?
I'm actually not sure. Okay. I think it might be. Yeah. Because I believe, I don't know if Anna was around when the animated movie came out.
No, nope. She would have died by then.
Yeah, so.
It seems like an interesting coincidence.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's great to hear about all of this coming together. And I'm sure your musical director, Brian Chung, is having fun putting all of the kind of the musical elements together. And I understand that there's quite a Carthage contingent that's part of this, even beyond you.
Yes. So, yeah. I'm a freshman in the musical theater department at Carthage.
And then I'm a junior in the musical theater department as well.
And I am a Carthage graduate, Carthage class of 23.
All right.
And our Gleb is a Carthage student. Our Czar/Gorlinski is a Carthage student. Our teen Anya is a Carthage student.
And one of the ballerinas are also a Carthage student. Well, actually, no, two of them.
Yeah. So Carthage is mad at me right now for taking all their best folks.
Well, you'll give them back shortly. So it opens this weekend. How many weekends are we talking about of performances?
We're running three weekends. We have Friday and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and then Sunday matinees at 2 p.m.
And if people want ticket information, what should they do?
They can go to rhodecenter.org. That's R-H-O-D-E center.org. And all of the ticket information is on there. Our opening night on Friday, we are actually holding a, quote, Romanov ball prior to the show time. It's going to start at about 5 o'clock. People can show up early, get one of our specialized drinks from the concession stand, hang out, mingle.
In that beautiful lobby.
Yeah.
Sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, and we'll hold the massacre off until later.
Very good. All right. So the musical Anastasia opens this weekend at the Rhodey Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha. Alex Ebert, the director, Brian Dean, Trevor Milne, and Peyton Kurianowicz, three of the leads in this cast for this big, wonderful show. Thank you to all of you for being part of the morning show today here on WGTD.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program dates from 2019. And now for the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, we will be hearing a powerful and poignant story of a refugee in the Holocaust, but a story very different from from most such stories. The guest that I'm speaking to is Mikhail Dekel, and it is her father who actually, in a sense, fled the Holocaust, but in a pathway very different. He was born and raised in Poland, but ultimately found his way to Iran and would be one of some 1,000 Polish children who were known as the Tehran children. And his long journey and harrowing journey and experience is told in a very intriguing and fascinating book called Tehran Children, A Holocaust Refugee Odyssey. Mikhail Dekel is a professor of English at City College of New York, and before this, author of The Universal Jew, Masculinity, Modernity, and the Zionist Movement. And this latest book is published by W.W. Norton and Company. Mikhail Dekel, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much.
You tell us in the book that your father was, in some respects, distant. Not that he wasn't a loving father, but he was not necessarily forthcoming about his life's experience. And so you knew relatively little about his wartime experience. Tell us how you came to understand more about what he had experienced, because that, of course, is, in a sense, a gateway to you writing this book.
That's right. Yes. So my father was a quiet, distant, somewhat enigmatic, somewhat depressive man. He never spoke about his wartime experiences or about his pre-war life. I was born and raised in Israel. He was my Israeli father. I didn't really know anything beyond that. In 2007, about 14 years after he died, I was talking to an Iranian colleague of mine at City College, and the colleague, Salar Abdo, asked me if I knew anything about children who were Holocaust refugees in Iran. I said, yes, my father was such a refugee, but I didn't know much more than that. And that initial conversation is what spurred the book that has now been published a month ago. So that's how the research started, and of course it took about a decade to find out all the details of this journey.
You tell us that he had said that much, that he was one of the so-called Tehran children, but that when you heard him refer to himself as one of the Tehran children, you never really thought of Tehran as a place. I mean, you obviously knew there was such a place named Tehran, but somehow you never really understood sort of the implications of that name.
That's right. And not only did I not understand the implications of that name, I didn't even think about my father as a Holocaust survivor, nor did he refer to himself as a Holocaust survivor. And this is not just my father, and this is not just even the 1,000 children who came with him. This is all the Polish Jewish refugees who, as you said, fled Nazi-occupied Poland into the Soviet Union and died or survived in the Soviet Union, in Central Asia, in Iran, India, mandatory Palestine, Lebanon, and so on. So these people were not considered Holocaust survivors. As far as Tehran went, yes, I didn't really think of Tehran as a place where my father lived during the war. I just thought of it as a sort of place of transit. I imagined his journey almost in a kind of fantastical way, his journey from Poland to Palestine through Tehran as something that was very instant. And in fact, I discovered that it was a 3.5-year long journey in which they traveled through half the world. They lived in Tehran for 7 months. And so it was an actual place, of course.
Right, and that ultimate journey from Poland to Iran, 5,000 miles that we are talking about. So an extraordinary journey in many respects. One of the most fascinating things in your book is when you tell us about the many written accounts that were gathered by to gather together the stories of these Tehran children. I mean, it was a very concerted effort, and one is certainly grateful for that, or otherwise many of these stories would be ultimately lost. Tell us more about the careful process by which many of these stories were gathered, and your long journey before you finally were able to uncover your father's own account of this experience.
Yes. So Poland, in 1939, Poland was occupied, became occupied both by the German forces and Soviet forces. So technically, Poland as a nation state no longer existed at the time. In London convened what we call the Polish government in exile. And that government very quickly decided that it would gather the testimonies of Polish citizens, Christian and Jewish, who were in the USSR and other places. And they were collecting this in part in order to have proof of atrocities that that Polish citizens experienced in the Soviet Union, and in part to have a record of this exile. So as part of this concerted effort, they also interviewed these Tehran children when they arrived to Palestine. They also interviewed some people in Iran. And those testimonies, even though they were gathered, you know, for somewhat of a propaganda purpose, ended up being wonderful sources of information for me and for other people researching this. My father's testimony, so I knew my father's testimony existed. I thought that all the testimonies were stored at the Hoover Institute in Stanford, but I did not find my father's testimony there. I was there twice. I worked very hard. I couldn't find it. One day, I was at a conference listening to a scholar talk about children's war testimonies, and that scholar quoted from my father's testimony. I was shocked, of course, and asked her where she got the testimony. She said, from a small archive in an ultra-Orthodox community in Israel. I wrote them. Immediately I got my father's testimony. It turned out that my father gave the testimony in Yiddish, not in Polish, and for whatever reason, it was stored in this particular very small off-the-beaten-path archive. So I was able to retrieve that. I was able to retrieve my father's account of his journey.
And that, of course, had to be a thrilling discovery for you, because without that, there was no way for you to know as many specifics as you did. And that ultimately, of course, allowed you to retrace your father's steps, at least to a large degree. One of the most moving aspects of this story is that it is not only the story of your father, but of his father and his father's brother. So this would be your grandfather and your great uncle. And in your words, this is an often repeated story, the tale of two brothers who had made two choices during the war. One had made the wrong choice to return to Nazi-controlled Poland, yet survived, and the other had made the right choice to remain in the Soviet Union and did not survive. It offered a grim moral lesson, the understanding of life as fundamentally ironic. Can you say a word about this aspect of your family's story?
Yes. So my family, my father's family, was a very large clan that lived in a town in Poland called Ostrów Mazowiecki. September 1939, when the war begins, that entire clan, or a big part of it, flees to the Soviet side. Part of that clan, my great uncle's family, remains on the Soviet border, just kind of on those towns in the Soviet border. My father's family decides that it's going to return to the German side. As punishment, the Soviets deport my father's family to Arkhangelsk, to Siberia, basically. In 1941, the Germans invade the Soviet Union, basically murder or ghettoize and later murder those Jews who are right on the border, including my great uncle and his family. The Jews that were deported as punishment for making, as I say, the stupid decision of wanting to return to Germany or to Poland, to German-occupied Poland, are released and, in fact, saved by their deportations, because the Nazis don't get that far into the Soviet interior in order to murder them. So this is the incident that I'm talking about, and it's not just my family. This is the story of many families in this situation.
And of course, it is one of those cases in which one is confronted by nearly impossible choices. And in so many cases, these are choices in which people are making the choices with little, if any, meaningful information whatsoever. And one realizes that, ultimately these choices were so capricious in nature, and whether or not one survived or not often had very little to do with one's own intelligence or good judgment. It was just impossible to know what choice to make in such an impossibly terrible situation. It must have been hard for you to think about your father and his family confronting something so awful.
Yes, that's absolutely right. As I said before, when I started out, I kind of had this fantasy, I guess, of a very quick journey somehow. But this journey was a long, arduous, arbitrary path of suffering. And as you said, at every moment, there is a decision to be made between bad and worse. Are we going to go with the Soviets, or are we going to go with the Germans? My family already experienced both a Soviet and a German occupation during World War I, and they survived the German occupation, so maybe the Germans will be okay this time. Then there are other decisions along the way. Do we separate from our children and send them alone to Iran, or do we keep them with us in Soviet Central Asia and possibly we all perish from starvation? There's a lot of agency and many decisions to be made. But I was also impressed by the way the family stuck together, the way the family were there for each other. It was very moving as well.
So you end up retracing, at least to a large extent, your father's long journey as a refugee. And one of the most striking things that you discover is that there are certain places, including the village where that family lived and made their fortune, in which, in a sense, all traces of the Jewish population that once lived there have been wiped clean, and other places where this story, in a sense, is properly remembered and memorialized. Talk for a moment about that striking difference that you found as you retraced your father's path as a refugee.
Right. So the book, as you just said, is not just about the past. It's also about the present, because in the book I travel to Poland, to Russia, to Uzbekistan, to Israel. A colleague of mine travels to Iran. So the book is also about the politics of remembrance, how the story is remembered in each one of those places. And in Poland, in my father's hometown, there are no traces of the family or of Jewish life. Actually, now there are some attempts to rebuild some of those traces, but when I visited, it was not there. In Russia, there is not exactly any memorialization of the no official memorialization of the deportations. There are some grassroots memorials. In Uzbekistan, I ended up going to the little village where my family had been, and the Uzbek farmers who'd lived there said, "We remember your ancestors. We pray for them each year. We remember how hungry they were. We remember that they ate live frogs, and we sort of prayed together," and that was a very moving moment. So, yes, remembrance is a national thing, right? Remembrance is a national thing. Nations do collective memory. And this is a transnational story. So in some ways, it kind of falls between the chairs, as many refugee stories do. My story, my book, tries to connect the dots between all these different nations and in itself become a kind of memorial for these refugees.
What do you want to say about your father's experience in Tehran when he was ultimately able to reach that far-off destination? About the experience that he had there?
The initial experience when the refugees arrive in Tehran or in Iran, in Pahlavi, which is a port in northern Iran, is very positive. Iran is the first nation that they encounter that hasn't been ravaged by war. It has bread, it has cars, it seems to the children pretty modern. And they're very warmly received by the Persian population. That's the initial stage. Later on, they are interned in a big Polish refugee camp. The children are interned in a kind of special Jewish home within that camp. And the local Jewish population rallies in. Jewish population of Palestine helps them, and so on. So then they kind of come under the care of Jewish organizations. So ultimately, the experience in Iran was very positive. At the end, after a number of months, there is a kind of outcry against the refugees, as we see today in many countries, because prices are going up, for the prices of bread are going up, and so on, and they end up having to leave. But ultimately, it's a pretty positive experience.
Yeah, it's really remarkable, and of course, it's a story that so many of us in the West do not know at all.
That's right.
I want you to explain an intriguing line early in the book when you are talking about your father's experience in his childhood before this horror envelops them. In this chapter, you say at one point, "Poland was a wound, my father's, my aunt's, and mine by inheritance." What do you mean by Poland being a wound? And did the experience of following your father's journey, in a sense, do anything to heal that wound for you?
Yes. The reason I say Poland is a wound, because as I realized, Poland was my father's family home for 8 generations. That's a long time. They were rooted in Poland. They were wealthy. They were a large clan. So being... having to leave and basically having that life end so abruptly was a wound that my father didn't want to talk about Poland. My aunt, when I would ask her what happened, she would just say, "Forget about it." Following my journey, I do feel somewhat differently. I appreciate the long life that they had there and the complex life, not only they, but the Jewish population of Poland. At the same time, it is complicated. It is complicated because in the 1930s, there was a great deal of anti-Semitism leading up to the war. Of course, during the Nazi occupation, the situation is terrible in Poland was terrible, and we know that 90% of Polish Jews perished. There is something still very, very eerie, of course, about that experience. But at the same time, I traveled to Poland. I now have Polish friends. I feel like my relationship to Poland has definitely normalized.
Mikhail Dekel is the author of this book called Tehran Children, A Holocaust Refugee Odyssey. The book is published by W.W. Norton and Company. This interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2019. Tomorrow on the morning show, an interview with a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage, Dr. Erin Weber. And we're going to be talking about the research that she is doing into potato viruses, and one potato virus in particular, known as virus Y, that can have potentially huge impact on potato crops all around the world. And she was recently granted a significant research grant from the National Science Foundation to continue and expand upon some of the research that she has done in order to help other scientists find out more about this virus and how it operates, how it does the damage that it does. It could be life-changing, world-changing. And we talk about that on tomorrow's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find the morning show archive on our website, wgtd.org. And also, you can hear the morning show via our podcast version. And by subscribing to that, you ensure yourself of hearing a different morning show 7 days a week. Look for the morning show with Greg Berg. Our skies are going to become sunny today. It will be windy today, winds up to 40 miles per hour, and we're headed for a high of 39 degrees. Overnight, clear, windy, and cold. Our overnight low is actually all the way down to 15. Sunny tomorrow and a high temperature of 28 degrees. Saturday, it looks like 2 to 3 inches of snow and otherwise cloudy skies and a high temperature of 33 degrees. Remaining chilly as we get into Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday with sunshine returning. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.